Welcome to Storytelling. This week's guest is a British Army veteran who turned adversity into inspiration. After 14 years of service, he founded a successful chauffeuring business, Purely Platinum. However, he battled depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and chronic spinal pain. A suicide attempt marked a turning point, leading him to sell his business and start Wellbeing 360, a mental health consultancy. He's also a global goodwill ambassador, founded Talk Mental Health Sick, and raise funds for charity. His impactful campaigns reach hundreds of thousands of people, and he completed a 385-mile trike ride to raise awareness for the 385 men who commit suicide monthly in the UK. His dedication earned him recognition and awards for his contributions to mental health awareness. Please welcome Nick Wilson.
Hello, Nick, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Debbie. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Nick, tell me about your time in the Army.
It was probably one of the best things in my life I've ever done. I served 14 years in the Royal Logistic Corps. Initially signed up as a professional driver trade, but that only lasted about a year or so. And after I'd done Northern Ireland and Kosovo, I think it was in 99, I became an instructor. And yeah, that was me pretty much for the rest of my time as an instructor trainer. And probably the best part of that career was when I was working at basic training in Purbright. It's a phase one establishment. So those taking civilians and putting them through their 14-week basic training to turn them into a standard soldier. And then they'll go off onto their phase two training, which is their specific trade training, or if they're going into infantry, etc. And I spent 2.5 years doing basic training around the time when Afghan was going on. And you got to the point, it's height, where the recruits, once they passed out after the 14 weeks, within 3 to 6 months of them leaving us, they were deploying to Afghan. Such was the demand and so short on numbers. And yeah, we were pulling 100, 110 hour weeks, almost living in the offices, just to give as much training, guidance, experience and advice to the guys and girls before we were the ones that had to put our names down to sign and say they are trained, they're good enough to be able to pass out and good enough to go on into the army. So we were very aware of where they were going and what that could mean for them. The reward from that, we had like even ex-gang members, ex-drugs fueled people. We, you know, the army was so desperately recruiting, and you were changing them from their past, whoever they were, whatever that might look like, and turning their lives around. And that was, it was amazing. There's just no words for the reward you get from that.
So you were a very active individual and mentor to a lot of young people. When did things change for you because you're now a disability advocate?
I was forced to leave the army after 14 and a half plus years, something like that. And it was due to a spinal injury that I had picked up from service. And initially, I went into started a chauffeur company, started a business, turned into a £250,000 business after 2 years, doing really well. But now I know that I missed all the red flags, all the red warnings, my complex post-traumatic stress disorder. As it was later diagnosed, I experienced massive burnout mentally and attempted suicide in 2016. And then I was diagnosed with complex post-traumatic stress disorder, did 3 weeks in rehab. And then from there, it all became about mental health, becoming a practitioner in cognitive behavioral therapy, neuro-linguistic programming, becoming a mental health first aid trainer. It was all about studying that whilst I was going through my own personal journey. And during this time, around about 2021, my spinal injury was declining. And then I ended up becoming more reliant on a powered wheelchair in around October 21. And so it's an ongoing transition, I guess, and having to constantly adjust to varying life challenges. And that's why I've kind of managed to get to where I am today.
So you mentioned that you had post-traumatic stress disorder and you went through a very traumatic experience of trying to commit suicide. Can you explain to us, was there any support for you around this time?
No, I certainly didn't feel there was. Obviously, that was 5 years ago. I can bring it right up to date. So April 2021, I was extremely suicidal and I'd learnt all the red flags and what to do and all that kind of stuff. And when I reached out for help, I experienced nothing but barriers and obstacles. Crisis team refused to speak to me. 999 couldn't deploy a paramedic because I hadn't actually acted on my thoughts. It was a really, really difficult time. Every single service available failed me locally, and my life was saved by a new military-specific service called Op Courage, which is available for military personnel, veterans, and their families. And it's a great service. They came out of area and they came down and intervened. And if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be here today. Unfortunately, a year after this, a men's mental health group that I run and one of the guys there and a good friend of mine, it was almost identical situation that he went through a year later in 2022. And unfortunately, he didn't have an Op Courage because he was a civilian and he took his life. He completed suicide. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult. People talk a lot about just signpost in, just ask for help. And whilst there are a lot of services out there, there's a lot of listening supports. It isn't just as easy as signposting someone and then they're going to get the help. Unfortunately, it's not always that straightforward.
What can we do to help support those who have suicidal thoughts, particularly if there aren't the services or help there for those who, as you say, they're in the early process of thinking about it, but their support isn't there until a bit further along?
Yeah, great question. It's exactly the area that I'm kind of campaigning and working in at the moment, because there's no community-based supports for those early days when you're experiencing suicidal thoughts. When you get into crisis, more stuff kicks in. And one of the best things that people can do is to ask them outright. You know, if you think someone's struggling a lot, and people talk about signs and symptoms all the time, right? For me, the top tip I give everyone is more a case of if someone's acting out of character, ask them the question, are you all right? I've noticed you've not been yourself lately. Is there anything I can do? If they start opening up to you and it's coming across that they're really, really struggling, ask them outright. Have you had any thoughts of taking your life? Have you had any thoughts of suicide? Have you got a plan in place? And if they come back with, well, yeah, actually, I have been having some thoughts, try not to overreact, okay? Thank them for sharing. Thanks you so much for sharing that with me. I really appreciate you trusting me. What can we do? What would you like me to do for you right now? Do you want me just to sit and listen? Do you want me to help you try and get some support? What do you need from me? The worst thing you can do is try and take over, try and take control, try and fix someone. A lot of the time, someone being there to listen fully, non-judgmentally, and just try and understand, ask questions. You know, if you're not sure, just ask someone. It really won't plant the seed or anything like that. And what someone really needs, we found through all the supports across the board, all the different ways, we need to get them on the list. Even if there's a waiting list for professional health services, get their name registered on that waiting list. And then it's about support. The ideal model is for people to kind of person-centered support, give them space, let them know that there's people they can go to, try and help them to identify what the problems are. So what's causing all of these thoughts? What are these problems, these challenges that are becoming overwhelming and making you feel like you've got no other option. Try and find ways to deal with that, if it's financially or emotionally or whatever it is. But people who have the love and support of friends and family, they tend to be the ones who get through it. When someone doesn't have all that love and support, they tend to be the ones who really struggle with it.
One of the things that you're campaigning for is support for suicide survivors. What would you say that is the main thing that you want to achieve?
There's two things for that for me. One is we need a greater sense of equality and inclusion within the wider suicide prevention conversation. So, for example, it's predominantly middle-aged white males who are talking about suicide right now. Nothing wrong with that, but we need to try and encourage others. We need a greater representation of survivors of suicide so we can ensure that every demographic of individual is being represented and has an opportunity to share their story. So that's kind of one side of it, is that equality, inclusion, and representation. If you look at the media, it's predominantly about bereaved families. They don't really speak to survivors of suicide. And I'm trying to work out why your ITV news, you know, Good Morning Britain, BBC Breakfast, why don't they have survivors of suicide on sharing their stories? Because the facts and the research says that actually informative, inspiring stories really help people who are struggling. So I'm trying to get that message across and identify why they don't, and they only speak to bereaved families. Not that there's a competition, do you know what I mean? It's all about equality and representation. And then the specific supports, I want to see community-based suicide prevention supports in place, specifically to intervene when people are first experiencing suicidal thoughts. There needs to be a new level. Like, I experience suicidal ideation now, and if I go for help, all they'll say is, well, are you in crisis? And I'm like, I'm not in crisis. I'm experiencing these thoughts. I'm not suicidal. So therefore, crisis doesn't really come into it. And it's suicidal thoughts aren't always about poor mental health. Mine is about the amount of pain I live in every day. It isn't about me mentally. And there's nowhere I can go. And this varies from region to region, whether there's any voluntary or charity or social enterprise organisations. There are some around the UK. But for example, the NHS doesn't provide a peer support service for people experiencing suicidal thoughts. So we need to have another level. You know, we need to be intervening a lot earlier.
One thing that you hit on earlier was the fact that these services have to be inclusive. And you mentioned the different diversity groups, but one particular group, those with disabilities, is particularly worrying for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Three times more men with disabilities and four times more women with disabilities die by suicide than their non-disabled counterparts. And when you try and understand the research or you try and find the research, further statistics, etc., it just doesn't exist. So there's, with the Disability Expo charity, we're kind of looking into this to try and understand more about why. And it's, again, it's that if you engage with survivors of suicide from different demographics, we can then learn so much more about where the barriers are, what the problems are, what pathways are working, which ones aren't, what support services are working, what the issues are for each demographic. And unfortunately, if you take, for example, the recent cross-government suicide prevention strategy they published 2 or 3 weeks ago with World Suicide Prevention Day on the 10th of September, apparently there were only something like 5% of survivors of suicide were engaged with throughout that entire strategy. So it's just not enough. And that kind of comes back to the whole equality and inclusion. They need to be engaging with survivors of suicide so much more. We need to better understand the issues. And when people with disabilities is the highest at-risk group of suicidal ideation and dying by suicide, we need to understand that better.
Nick, can you tell us about the library?
I'm so glad you mentioned that, David. Yeah, so I've just started a new project. It's been in my mind and planning for the past year, and it's called the Lived Experience Library. And the whole idea is to share people's stories of their lived experiences with disability, mental health, and suicide. It's to better inform society. It's also to inspire and empower individuals who are struggling with any of those elements. And it's also creating the UK's first virtual library of these different elements. So each story is going to be done in video, filmed in person. There's also going to be an audio podcast. They'll then be tagged and they'll be searchable. So if you are a 25-year-old black woman with trauma of racism, being very specific there, if you'll be able to search the library for something like that, and things closest to that will have someone sharing their story. A black female who's experienced racism and the trauma will come up, and they can hear someone else's story of what they've experienced, but also what they did, how they managed to cope, how they managed to move forward. And each episode finishes with a message of hope. So the idea is, again, it's all about that equality, inclusion and representation.
Nick, can you tell us about your upcoming trip to climb Mount Snowdon?
Yes, absolutely. So I've teamed up with a local engineering firm where I live in Northamptonshire called Rock Engineering. And I approached them and said, can you build me a power mobility chair that can take me up Snowdon? Totally naively, not fully understanding what I was actually asking of them. And that is coming up to a year ago. And we are just about getting ready to announce a reveal date, hopefully in October, November time, for Rock Climber. This thing is, there's nothing like it in the world. And we've checked. The Institution of Engineering and Technology have also partnered with us, which is so amazing. And the idea is this thing, which has got like 24-inch wheels, it's got four motors, four gearboxes, it can climb 35-degree inclines. And the idea is to do a solo ascent of Mount Snowdon, which is the highest mountain in England and Wales, on Rock Climber. I'll have a safety team, and we're going to do it right. But at the moment, wheelchairs going up Mount Snowdon is nothing new. The charity Backup, they do an annual pull-up. But it takes a team of 16 to 20 people to drag wheelchairs and their owners up the mountain. What we want to do is to demonstrate how modern-day engineering technology can help to overcome accessibility issues within both urban and rural environments. And current power chair developers just aren't really, they're not producing them. And we feel that we should be adapting to our environments opposed to adapting the environments to suit us, especially out in nature, right? You don't want to be building big concrete paths up a mountain or something. So, yeah, so we're building this amazing thing. I've also told them that by 2025, I want to cross the Mojave Desert in it. Using only solar energy, but we haven't announced that one officially yet because they're still kind of scratching their chins.
You know what, Nick? I'm so excited on your behalf. It's almost like I'm there with you. So please keep us up to date on those adventures. And I just want to thank you for sharing your story with suicide and for the very important advice for all those listening. And thank you for being a guest on this podcast.
It's an absolute honour. Thank you ever so much to you, Debbie, for all you do, the amazing work you do, and for giving me this opportunity.
If you have been affected by the issues raised in today's episode and would like further information and help, and you would also like information about Nick Wilson, then please follow the link in the show notes.